This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Thank you for joining us for our broadcast and online Main Street all across our state of North Dakota. A book and upcoming PBS special examines the Right to Die movement. Diane Rehm is the author of When My Time Comes, Conversations About Whether Those Who Are Dying Should Have the Right to Determine When Life Should End. Her book focuses on medical aid in dying. It's a process where people diagnosed as terminal, having 6 months or less to live, can request help to end their lives. In places where it's legal, the terminal diagnosis must be made by two doctors, and the patient must be able to self-administer the life-ending medication. It's expensive, and it's not covered by insurance. In her book and PBS show, Rehm interviews doctors, religious leaders, terminally ill patients, and their loved ones about the realities and misconceptions around death. Rehm spoke with Main Street's Ashley Thornburg.
Diane, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
The book starts with a very personal story about how this area of interest came to be something that you felt very strongly about. And then woven throughout, you continue to hear stories from your personal life. So I'd like to ask you if you could start with the story of your own mother and your own first husband and how those two lives and deaths brought you to this cause.
Well, you know, I think that my mother's death when I was 19 and she was just 49, she was dying of liver cancer in a hospital bed where they kept draining her of liquid that kept building up. She looked as though she were almost 11 months pregnant. I mean, it was so difficult. And I can remember that very last time I was in her room when they brought her back from draining her. And she said, "Why don't they just let me die? I want to die. I don't want to go through this again and again." And of course, back then, there were absolutely no laws in the country allowing medical aid in dying. Now, there are 9 states plus the District of Columbia that do allow it. But then my husband of 54 years was in a nursing home in Maryland, having suffered from severe Parkinson's disease for 10 years. And in the end, he could not feed himself. He could no longer stand on his own. He couldn't bathe himself. He literally could do nothing for himself. So he was in a nursing home, but I had hired a helper to be there with him for 8 hours a day, just to do the simple, ordinary things that we all take for granted. And finally, he said, "I am ready to die." He said, "I have fallen into such indignity, and if I continue to live, I know that this indignity is going to go even deeper." So he talked to his doctor, he talked to me, our daughter, who is a doctor, our son. And our daughter, I can remember her saying, "But Dad, we can keep you comfortable." And he said, "Damn it, I don't want comfort. I am ready to die." So as I said, he was in the state of Maryland. There was no law that would have allowed him to have medical aid in dying. So instead, he did the only thing he could do. He stopped eating, he stopped drinking water, and he stopped taking medication. And actually, it took 10 long days for that poor man to die. And it was really painful for him, for all of us. And I just think people should have the right to choose how they die when they have a fatal illness.
I think that that last part there, when they have a fatal illness, is the part that we need to concentrate on. So just putting the absolute finest point possible on this, anybody, does that mean they have to have a terminal diagnosis, 6 months or less to live? Or if someone is 30 and in a condition where they're not comfortable, they're not happy, they face the same indignities, but they could live another 30 years. Are those people in that same group for you?
You're talking about the difference between medical aid in dying when one does have a terminal illness and one has been declared by two physicians to be within 6 months of death. That person in nine states plus DC can request medical aid in dying. In the case of a 30-year-old who is simply sad, miserable, feels he or she has no hope for the future, there you're talking about suicide, which is a choice to live or to die. People who have or are suffering at the end of life have no such choice.
This project started out as a film and then later became a book. Usually those kinds of things are the other way around. When did this interest area become something more than a personal passion project for you, something that you knew needed to get out there more?
Well, as you perhaps know, I am both the narrator and the interviewer in the film. We went across the country. We interviewed 50 people or more, and I'm talking about doctors, nurses, patients, survivors, loved ones who've lost someone, loved ones who are still with an individual who has been deemed terminally ill. So about a year into the process, I was working on a totally different book, and I realized that I no longer had any interest in that book I was writing, that this film project had so enveloped me that I felt it needed a book as well. And so I began writing and taking each of 25 or so interviews, writing an introduction to each, making sure that, like the film, the book has representation from all points of view. People who are totally opposed to medical aid in dying, people who plan to use medical aid in dying, people who have been left behind because their loved ones have chosen medical aid in dying. So the film will be distributed by PBS across the country beginning mid-April. But the book, which you now have in your hand, has just come out in paperback. It came out in hardback a year ago, but now we are very close to film time. So I think that people are particularly interested in how this book and film go together. And don't forget, there's a wonderful introduction to the book written by one of my very favorite authors, John Grisham, who, like me, believes that people should have the right to choose.
A lot of the opposition people that you spoke with in the book, they come at it oftentimes from a spiritual or religious tradition that only God is able to decide when life ends. Other people are concerned that this might be used, that people might be coerced into this, people who are from minorities or people who are disabled. And I'm really curious about the process in this instance, since you have publicly testified, lobbied, and been in support of the medical aid in dying movement. And normally a journalist, of course, has a lot of training in how to talk to people on most or on all sides of an issue. But when you have spoken publicly and people know what your point of view is, do you think that that impacted when you were talking to people who have an opposing point of view?
I really did my work with individuals who are opposed to medical aid in dying by listening, which is, as you well know, a very important part of what we as journalists do. And my point of view was not the important one. The important one was the person I was interviewing. So, for example, a Roman Catholic priest talked about some of the passages in the Bible and the teachings of the church. A physician in Oregon, the very first state to adopt medical aid in dying, who is very opposed to that law, talked about why he believes so strongly that doctors should not be involved in medical aid in dying, that in fact their role should be to go on a journey with the patient as far as possible, to be there to comfort, to help, to provide everything possible for that person. I have no argument with that whatsoever. I believe if people feel that God should be the only decider, I support them 100%. And if an individual says, I want everything that medical science can offer, please don't let me die, I support them 100%. And I also believe that those who wish to have medical aid in dying should be supported equally. So I do believe it was a learning process for me, a teaching process, in the sense that I learned more and more about why, for example, people of color are so mistrusting of the medical profession. The pastor Lamar of the African Methodist Episcopal Church said to me, think about what happened to blacks in Tuskegee. Think about how they were duped and deliberately infected with syphilis. Think about the fears of people who are disabled, who do fear that their lives may be taken because they are less than perfect. On the other hand, you may be interested in knowing that when the law was being debated, or the proposal was being debated here in the District of Columbia, the disabled community, if you will, was divided. Some said because one of the provisions of the law says that the individual must self-administer the medication. Well, that could leave out a good many disabled people, such as those with ALS or Lou Gehrig's disease. And many of those, the District of Columbia, to say, you're leaving me out. Why is this fair to me? So you learn a lot about the very different ideas and thoughts that people have, and I respect them all. I was not trying to convince anyone. I was there to listen and report.
In the book, you talk about the differences in how people die now versus how people died 50, 60, 70 years ago, when the combination of there wasn't as much access to healthcare, you know, major facilities, and there also just wasn't the actual technology. You know, people were far more likely to kind of drop dead suddenly. There might be a stroke or a massive heart attack, whereas now people have conditions that are, you know, treatable and manageable over time. But I'm thinking of that heart attack or even a gunshot. 50, 100 years ago, there wasn't much hope of surviving that because of the lack of medical knowledge and technology.
Quite right.
And now there is. Do you worry about a potential loss in future quality of life by patients perhaps with Lou Gehrig's or with Parkinson's, that, you know, maybe 50 or 100 years from now, people might have a much higher quality of life? And do you worry that we are losing that potential?
You see, I think the one thing you are missing here is that this is a matter of choice. This is not foisted on anyone. Even within some parts of Europe where euthanasia is allowed, an individual must request it and go through a series of exercises and answer a long list of questions before that is applied. Now, we are likely never going to come to euthanasia in this country. And so many of the opponents to medical aid in dying like to compare medical aid in dying with euthanasia, and the two are totally different. In one, the patient must self-administer. In Europe, a doctor can administer an injection and put that patient quietly, peacefully to death. In this country, in these nine states, there must not only be two doctors who agree that the patient is within 6 months of death, but in some cases, in some states, a psychiatrist must examine that individual by him or herself, with no relatives around, with no friends present, to ensure that that person is not being coerced. So if you are clear in your understanding about this, medical aid in dying is all about choice. So that 50 or 100 years from now, unless global warming takes us all, if there are ways for a person with ALS to, God willing, have a cure, how wonderful that would be. And the same with Parkinson's disease and cancer and so many other problems that we face now. But you and I live in the present. And what we hope to do with this film and this book is to get people to talk with their families, their doctors, their friends about what it is they want. And they may say to that doctor, I want everything. Please keep me alive as long as possible. Or I really do believe God will take me when my time comes. And I will wait for that. Or they may say, I really am ready to go. So it is what you want and what you convey to your next of kin, your loved ones. Let them know. Have that conversation.
That's Diane Rehm, author of When My Time Comes, Conversations about Whether Those Who Are Dying Should Have the Right to Determine When Life Should End, visiting with Ashley Thornburg. Coming up, more of their conversation, including what a good death means, after the news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. A state senator from Williston says he continues to work toward getting inpatient treatment for addiction in western North Dakota. Right now, there are no facilities west of Bismarck for that treatment, and several studies have shown the need to offer treatment in the west.
We can find the treatment providers. In fact, we've had great interest from treatment providers that want to come to those areas, but you have to have facilities.
Republican Brad Beckedahl is also a Williston City Commissioner. Beckedahl says building those facilities is expensive.
We looked at a wing in our hospital in Williston that the county and the city wanted to renovate for the hospital to put in the inpatient program. And to provide 8 treatment rooms was a cost of $4 to $6 million.
Beckedahl says there was talk about funding those facilities in the bonding bill. He says the Senate will take a look at putting something in the budget for human services. An investigation into the recent jump in natural gas prices is getting underway in North Dakota. Public Service Commission Chair Julie Fedorchak.
Because the prices are what they are and customers will start paying for them this time around, how can we mitigate that by perhaps spreading those costs over a larger number of months to keep a spike from impacting customers heavily in one billing cycle?
Xcel Energy and Montana Dakota Utilities say they had little choice but to pass the sudden price increase onto residential, business, and industrial customers. Utilities across the country found themselves in the same position after the recent cold and record-setting snow in several southern states. And the State Highway Patrol, Department of Transportation, and AAA North Dakota have partnered in a program aimed at reducing the number of impaired drivers. The program is called ND Sober Ride. Under it, someone who decides not to get behind the wheel and needs a ride can use a special code and can get $10 off their ride home with Lyft. Bill Panos is the director of North Dakota DOT.
ND Sober Ride provides a real-world solution for those who are under the influence of drugs and or alcohol. Many states across the country, Colorado, Nevada, Wisconsin, offer rideshare options through sponsorships or other funding sources. North Dakota is joining that list.
Hano says the goal is to expand it to other ride-sharing services and taxi companies. The program starts today, coinciding with the Drive Sober or Get Pulled Over campaign, which runs through March. AAA is providing a $10,000 grant for the program. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Today we're airing a conversation with Diane Rehm about her book and PBS special. The book is titled When My Time Comes, Conversations About Whether Those Who Are Dying Should Have the Right to Determine When Life Should End. She spoke with our Ashley Thornburg about advance directives, written statements of a person's wishes regarding medical treatment if that person is unable to communicate. In her book, Rehm tells the story of a woman who had a do not resuscitate order on file with her doctors, but paramedics didn't know that when they found her unresponsive.
And she was absolutely furious because she had done everything. She had written everything down. But someone called 911, and there she was in the hospital, waking up.
Right. They don't know your advance directive always.
Well, that's the point. It's not enough.
So what do you recommend? I mean, you said talk to your family, but do you need to have a lawyer present too? Do you need this to be totally, dot your I's, cross your T's, legalized? Or is it enough for me to make an iPhone recording for my sisters and say, this is what I want? In addition, and I do already have an advance directive, if the people who find you don't know your advance directive, or if you fall under a case where your advance directive doesn't get listened to, what else is there?
That's why I, as you know, in the book, did record something on my grandson's cell phone.
Yeah.
And while he was recording with me, our videographer was recording him so that he is in the film recording me for my wishes to be known, which they already are, to my children, my grandchildren. I want them all to know exactly what I want. During the making of this film, I went to my own doctor at the time, and I said, tell me, are you in favor of medical aid in dying? And she said, no, I'm really not interested in participating in that. So I changed doctors. I found a doctor who will support me in medical aid in dying. So my very doctor knows, all of my neighbors know, all of my friends know exactly how I feel.
That is a bit of a sea change in medicine. It wasn't that long ago you just had no choice but to listen to doctors' orders, and you didn't question what the doctor said. Now there is much more interplay.
Well, doctors 40, 50 years ago were gods. I mean, whatever they said, we did. And now we are likely to ask more questions, not only about our own health care. We're likely to ask about medications, how much it's likely to help, what the side effects are. You know, we're more knowledgeable as consumers of health care now, and we're far more courageous about asking doctors. And I must say, doctors are far more likely to respond honestly and directly. However, I must tell you that it is the Roman Catholic Church that is the most highly opposed to medical aid in dying, and more hospitals are now being controlled by the Roman Catholic Church. And therefore, if you happen to end up in one of those hospitals, the doctors are under the restrictions of the Roman Catholic Church. So that too is something individuals who care about this need to think very carefully about.
It's been said about philosophy and yoga and certain religious traditions and even on a lighter level, the Marie Kondo's life-changing magic of tidying up, that ultimately what you're doing when you go through this process is figuring out if you are living according to your values. You are learning how to die, and in the process, you are learning if you are leading a life that you find to be valuable, ethical.
That is such a wonderful point, such a perfect point. And it was the point that my husband was making. He was a brilliant lawyer. He worked in the Kennedy and Johnson administrations. He became the first general counsel for the office of the U.S. Trade Representative. and indeed went on to have a wonderful career in private practice. So he knew what quality of life meant. He provided such a wonderful quality of life for me, for his children, for the people around him. He was such a good listener. And he did everything he could to make the people around him feel comfortable and comforted. But when the end approached, and the doctor told him that he was within 6 months of dying, and the doctor said, "I wish I could help you, but I cannot, because we are here in the state of Maryland." So I think that issue of how your own ideals are reflected in how you live your life are also reflected when the time comes when you wish to die.
When you were going through this own process of telling your neighbors, finding a doctor who would support you, recording this with your grandson, Benjamin, and going through that process of examining your values and your own approach to living in how you would at least hope to find the best death possible for you, did anything change in the way that you were living your life?
I think, especially in this year of COVID, the first thing I did was to call my doctor and to say to her, "I want you to understand that should I come down with the virus, number one, I will not go to a hospital. Number two, I will not be intubated. I realize that that may sound drastic to many people, but we are only now beginning to understand the after effects of intubation and this virus, even for those who have recovered from it." So I had no wish to be hospitalized. And she very kindly and wisely said, "Well, we can provide you oxygen at home without being intubated. We can only provide 140%, whereas in a hospital, we can give you 160%. But I understand your choice, and I accept it, and I will make a note in your chart." Now, that's just one small example of how doing this film and being with people who have suffered the deaths of their loved ones, and especially watching my own husband die, that really has changed my life a lot.
Diane, I'm going to ask you a question you asked a number of people in your book. What is a good death for Diane Rehm?
That is very much the same question I did ask each and every one of the people with whom I spoke. And it's so interesting because each of them, no matter whether they were for or against medical aid in dying, every single one of them had the same answer as I wish to be in my own home, surrounded by my family, my dearest friends. I wish to be with them, to perhaps have a glass of champagne, to tell stories, to hear stories. And then when I know my time has come, to go to my own bedroom, to be just with my husband and my children and grandchildren, take that medication and go peacefully.
Diane, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you for your interest and your wonderful questions. It was a pleasure to talk with you.
That was Diane Rehm, author of When My Time Comes, Conversations About Whether Those Who Are Dying Should Have the Right to Determine When Life Should End. She also narrates an upcoming PBS special about the Right to Die movement, and she was speaking with our Ashley Thornburg. Tom Ezern is next.
Join us for a very special program as we bring you the best audio documentaries of the year, the winners of the 2020 Third Coast Competition. Chosen from more than 700 entries, the 11 winners are beautifully crafted original stories from around the world. Come celebrate audio storytelling at its finest with Best of the Best from the Third Coast Festival.
Best of the Best coming up tonight at 8 Central, 7 Mountain on Prairie Public.
Welcome back to Main Street on Prairie Public. The pandemic forced us to limit our contacts and keep our distance. But vaccination promises to ease us back to getting together and traveling for the fun of it. History professor Tom Ezern has been thinking about that, and in today's Plainsfolk essay, he offers some suggestions for the state's marketing strategy for tourism. His piece is titled, Matching Wits with the Fits.
Being a professional historian, an inveterate traveler, and an ardent exponent of life on the plains, I have a long-standing interest in heritage tourism, especially heritage tourism of a particular kind. In the 20th century, a distinctive profile emerged for that wily tourist known as the independent traveler. Lately, a new acronym has emerged in the trade literature. FIT, F-I-T, which means Free Independent Traveler. I like it. Lay aside your conceptions of tourism as something that operates with charter buses, cruise ships, packaged tours, or group things of any sort. To pull in custom today, you have to match wits with the fits. Which are what exactly? The free independent traveler has some common characteristics. Fits write their own itineraries. They don't like packages or linear journeys. They are tech-savvy masters of digital communications. They travel on their own, often by personal vehicle. They are adventuresome and open to unexpected things. They have disposable income, quite a bit of it. They respect places and communities because they love them. Let me reiterate those last two things. Fits have money, and they are good guests. These are the tourists you want. And what do they want? It's not that complicated. First, real things in real places. Not water slides or whatever else you may be thinking about building for them. Instead, identify, preserve, and market the good things that you already have. Second, stories. This is advertising 101, really. To promote an attraction or experience, you have to attach narrative to it, preferably true narrative. Nor do you have to dumb it down. Layered, rich narratives are good. Third, active and interactive experiences. Things you can touch, climb on, experience in tactile and sensory ways. Like, oh, I don't know, perhaps the historic Northern Pacific Railroad Bridge spanning the Missouri River at Bismarck. The old NP Bridge is a real thing with a powerful sense of place. In fact, it is essential to that Missouri Valley sense of place that defines the twin towns of Bismarck and Mandan. Fitz can get into this. Especially if you tell the story, or stories, the stories of George Shattuck Morrison, the greatest bridge builder in American history, of the hard-working blokes who went down in the caissons, sank the foundations, laid the stone, did all the hard work, and experienced all the perils of making this real thing palpable. Of Theodore Roosevelt and all the other venturesome cattlemen who poured across the bridge with their beasts to invest the Badlands and the whole Northern Plains, and 100 other narratives stacked like pancakes. As for interactive experiences, that part is a slam dunk. People keep talking about a pedestrian bridge after the BNSF takes its engines and trains off. That's not the right word at all, pedestrian. This bridge is a platform for experience and engagement. Now find a word that says that. Oh, and one more thing. We keep referring to the historic bridge as endangered, like it is some sort of liability. It is rather a resource, and more than that, an opportunity. It is not often that a man can make opportunities for himself, Roosevelt wrote in his autobiography, but he can put himself in such shape that when or if the opportunities come, he is ready. Are we fit for it? Once again, what would Teddy do?
That's Tom Easern. Next, another dollop of history, Dakota Date Book.
Capital Shakespeare, in partnership with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, presents A Doll's House. In Henrik Ibsen's groundbreaking play, a childlike wife and mother, accustomed to an existence built around her husband, comes to confront the truth of her marriage. Performances start at 7 p.m. nightly, March 5th and 6th, and March 7th at 2 p.m. at the Russell Reed Auditorium in the North Dakota Heritage Center and State Museum, and are free and open to the public. More information can be found online at capitalshakespeare.org.
When you hear arts programming here on Prairie Public, know that it is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, and we thank them.
This is Dakota Datebook for March 2nd. One would think that in a state with as many rock piles as we have, there would be field stone buildings everywhere, but they tend to be uncommon. The Buffalo Herald newspaper described Angus Beaton, a stonemason from Nova Scotia, as a reliable expert in the handling of brick and stone. Beaton was an early homesteader in southeast North Dakota and was responsible for building the historic Calvary Episcopal Chapel in Buffalo in 1885. Now known as the Old Stone Church, it was the first stone church built in Cass County and the third in Northern Dakota Territory. The building was architect George Hancock's first stone church design to also include a stone tower. While the building has since been rescued, the tower disappeared many years ago. Stonemason Beaton was only 52 when he died on this date of meningitis in 1898. It was about 20 years later when several stone buildings were erected near Ryder. Daniel Jackson and Anna Goodall were both homesteading claims in Blue Hill Township, southwest of Minot, when they first met. They married in 1906 and shared a dream of someday having a fieldstone house similar to one Anna remembered from Norway. They started with a split-level chicken coop in 1912, built entirely of fieldstone. It had two stories. Feed, stored on the upper level, reached the main floor through chutes. The main house was built 6 years later, in 1918. Anna designed the home and supervised the construction. When it was finished, the house was a showplace, two stories built of large, hand-cut stones. Smaller, rounded stones were used for design elements and the chimneys. The main floor had a large living room, fireplace, library, master bedroom, and bathroom, and a walk-in basement housed the kitchen, dining room, furnace, and storeroom. Up in the Turtle Mountains is the Coughlin Castle, a whimsically designed five-bedroom stone mansion on a hill east of St. John. An Irishman, Maurice Coughlin, and his sons built the castle, complete with cupolas and a turret. Coughlin homesteaded there in 1883, and when he built his masterpiece in 1904, it was considered a very grand affair. It included a heating plant for hot water and indoor plumbing, a grand central staircase, and was the only house in the region with hardwood floors. In 2008, it became listed on the National Register of Historic Places, and efforts to preserve it are ongoing. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Mary Helm. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
Many students can't get comfortable with school on a computer screen, but certain kids are thriving.
It's a lot easier for me to focus. I can be in my room and feel a lot more comfortable doing stuff in my room.
Online learning success stories on the next Morning Edition from NPR News.
Starting at 4 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
Thank you for joining us today for Main Street. As we broadcast, we stream online at prairiepublic.org. And after our broadcast or stream, you can find any Main Street show archived as a podcast at prairiepublic.org. Wednesday on our show, Prairie Pulse television show host John Harris will visit with Dennis Beck about a new North Dakota nonprofit he calls the Wall of Honor. It's an effort to salute local heroes in North Dakota using digital indoor billboards. We hope you can join us for Main Street on Wednesday. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.